Hello, Radioland, Podcastville, and all the ships at sea. My name is Seth Greenland, and you are listening to the LARB Radio Hour, brought to you by reader-supported Los Angeles Review of Books. Author Dana Johnson is here. Get the kids out of the room. She's going to be talking about sex writing. Ray Dubo will be joining us. She is the creator, the CEO, the diva of Talking Out Loud, a service that helps writers with their public presentations. She helps them suck less. Maybe she can help us. Author Antoine Wilson visits us in the studio to tell us why we should be reading the Heinrich von Kleist novel Michael Kohlhaas, which is a coincidence because I was wondering that just the other day. We had Dinesh D'Souza on the last show talking about his jail time, and it was so fascinating, particularly when he got into that part about the shows they would put on, that we ran long. And because of that, we had to bump BJ Novak, who has been gracious enough to come back today. So if you stay tuned, you will hear BJ Novak later in the program.
Yeah, thanks for understanding, BJ.
Joining me are my usual co-conspirators, Tom Lutz. Hello, Tom.
Hey.
And Lori Weiner. Hi, Lori.
Hi, Seth.
Dana Johnson is joining us today. She is an author. She's a professor at the University of Southern California. Welcome, Dana.
Thank you.
There was a rumor going around town that with all the journalistic machinery I have behind me, I investigated. And the rumor was that Dana Johnson, you know that writer, she teaches a course at USC. I said, yeah, I know she teaches at USC in writing sex scenes. And I investigated this deeply, and we got you to come on the show, and apparently I'm entirely wrong.
Yeah, I don't teach a course on writing sex scenes at all. But this summer at Squaw Valley Community of Writers, I did a craft talk on writing effective sex scenes, so that's probably where this rumor got started.
And how did you hit on that? Why did you do it?
Like most people, I always just sort of avoided sex scenes because I just thought they're just kind of gross in general. I don't know how to write them without writing porn or being trite. And so I just avoided them for years. But then I ended up writing a story about a stripper and her porn star boyfriend. And obviously, you can't avoid writing sex scenes when you have two characters like that.
Yeah.
But I really wanted to do them in a way that was interesting and funny and characterized these two people so that it wasn't just about sex scenes, but more about how these people related to each other and what they thought about each other. So I ended up having so much fun writing this story. I wrote two stories about these characters.
Elmore Leonard is very well known for his 10 rules of writing, one of which is no adverbs.
Right.
And which I think is a great one. And I'm very curious now, I'm sure, you know, you didn't do a PowerPoint or anything like that, but what are the rules of writing a good set? Oh, maybe you did. Maybe you did. Dana's waving a piece of paper around right now for you listeners. So what are the rules?
This is from a book called The Joy of Writing Sex by Elizabeth Benedict, and it's 10 general principles. And one is a sex scene or description is not a sex manual. A good sex scene does not have to be about good sex. It's okay to be aroused by your own writing. I don't know about that point, but we'll move on.
We'll come back to that.
Your fear is your best friend. And I really like that point because it's that idea of like, I couldn't possibly write that down. Well, if you're thinking it, it's probably real. And only your characters know for sure what to call it. I like that one too because not everyone's going to say penis. Some people are going to say cock. Some people are going to say vagina. Some people are going to say pocketbook. Whatever you're calling whatever your parts are. And a good sex scene is always about sex and something else. I think that's true. So to me, these questions are getting away from like, let's write about sex, but more about people and what people think and do.
And character.
Yeah. And character.
How did your listeners or your students, were they excited to be talking about it or did they see it as a problem?
No, I think everybody was really excited to be talking about it. And I do think there was a little bit of embarrassment because it was an audience that had both men and women in it. And so I was reading several passages from literature, from Toni Morrison to Don DeLillo. And I think there was a little bit of squeamishness, and yet people were really interested in the topic. And after I gave the talk, someone said after, I could have never stood up there and said, like read those sentences. And yet it's literature. We all read them.
Was there something in those passages of good sex writing that, that united them in some way?
Yes, actually, there's two of them actually that are from Toni Morrison's The Bluest Eye. And they're not sexy scenes. They're scenes, well, one of them's where one of the main characters, Charlie, is sexually abusing his daughter. And so it's a sex scene, but it's really about who this man is. And Morrison found a way to write about this violation. And the other one from Bluest Eye was a scene where Polly, the little girl, Pecola's mother, is remembering a time before their familial dysfunction when she was actually in love with Pecola's father. So I read those two scenes back to back to show sort of how sex is working in Morrison. And it's not about sex, it's about these people.
And do you have an example of a really bad one?
I was going to.
Yes.
Oh, goody, she's got one. Oh,
here we go. Out comes the paper again.
It's a book that came out in 2004, and it's a young woman who's in an unhappy marriage, and so she's having an affair. We repair to the bedroom. Clothes are eliminated quickly. We are both slicked in a light dew of sweat, but neither of us cares. I lick his neck and shoulders, loving the salty sweetness of him. He pushes me on the bed, on top of the covers, and begins to ravish me. With his mouth and hands.
That's verbs we should not use. Verbs we should not
use. Very unspecific.
I cannot think about anything except his touch and the sensations he creates and how much I love him, how much I've missed him. And I quickly find myself in the throes of a toe-curling orgasm. So that's like five cliches in a row. I want to sing. I want to weep. I want. And then the last paragraph is he moves up the bed and lies beside me, stroking my face and hair and shoulders and breasts and kissing me lightly. That's all right. I reach for him and pull him on top of me, and he enters me like a warm fog. And the warm fog.
Like a warm fog.
So he has
like
no penis.
I know. It's like you basically can't feel him down there. So I don't know.
That was, there's a scene in Sex and the City where Samantha was dating a man with a very small penis. And at one point she says to him, you know, you can put it in now. And he's like, it's been in for 15 minutes. Anyway.
Yeah, I just, you know, well, from the very beginning, we repair to the bedroom. Mm-hmm. I just thought, this is a contemporary young woman in New York. Who says repair? It just seems like she borrowed from some romance novels or something. And comparing a penis to fog is just wrong. It's just wrong.
And not to mention insulting.
Right. And confusing.
It's very confusing.
Because now we're thinking about the weather instead.
Right. And like it's warm, because I thought in general fog was kind of cool.
Yeah, necessarily. Yeah.
I don't know.
This is Seth Greenland. I'm here with Tom Lutz and Lori Weiner. We are talking to Dana Johnson here on KPFK 90.7 FM, the LARB Radio Hour.
So what are the no-nos?
I'll just read a couple. He knelt between her silken thighs, his throbbing manhood.
Oh, throbbing manhoods. I think we're done with that one, right?
Poised at her entrance.
Which entrance?
It's by the token booth, I think.
Exactly. Is that on
at
the...
At least he was poised, though.
I mean, she opened the front door and she's like, no, absolutely not.
No, exactly. There's a nub of flesh. There's a love button.
Oh!
And then the weather theme continues with, and with each pulse came a sensual rain that eased his way even more. So there's rain down there too.
Yeah, it's like a whole tropical forest.
I'm just seeing them in galoshes and wrapped in ponchos.
It's like it's something you should probably see a doctor about if it's raining down there. So those are, you know, some examples.
All right. So having become a student of bad sex writing and good sex writing too, when you approach a sex scene now in your authorial life, do you dread it? Because you know how easy it is to go off the beam? Or do you welcome it and think, okay, I really know how to do it. Now I can kick ass in this scene.
I actually welcome it now that I think about it as characterization.
Mm-hmm.
if I just keep thinking about it as characterization and not a sex scene, it's really fun to write because I love writing character.
Mm-hmm. What about this for a theory? If it's not pivotal, I'm not going to write it as a sex scene.
Right.
And it needs that pivotal aspect for at least one, hopefully both of the characters.
Right, exactly.
Otherwise, it becomes an exercise in florid writing.
Right.
Really.
Right.
You talked about that you should maybe not be aroused when you're writing a sex scene. I have a friend who is a novelist, and she was, you know, going to write a sex scene that day, and she was said, you know, I'm looking forward to it. And she said that one of the ways that she decides whether it's successful or not is whether it does arouse her or not. So it's not verboten to
do that. Actually, I didn't even, because I agree, if it's supposed to be a sex scene between people who like each other, maybe even hate each other, I don't know, that I probably am thinking it's a kind of a hot scene depending on the subject matter. Obviously, the Morrison example I gave is not. In the scenes that I wrote, I like to have fun with them, and they were, I thought, a little sexy. But I also tend to write the sex off the page, so I like to write the things that are leading up to the moment that are really kind of, it's sort of Victorian in that way. Mm-hmm. And then you know sort of what, I have an example of a scene that I wrote.
We would love to hear that.
This is from my short story, Break Any Woman Down. And it's Bobby who does porn and his girlfriend, LaDonna. And I wanted to sort of make fun of the silly scenes in porn. And so it opens with them watching Bobby, a video of Bobby in a scene of his own. In the movie, Bobby stepped through the door with a sack full of groceries, mostly fruit, a bunch of bananas, zucchini, real corny. Nice lighting, though, warm. Miss Hazelton, I'm delivering the goods you requested. Delivery boy, come in. I have some odds and ends I need you to take care of. And then Bobby was getting his dick sucked. The both of us watched Bobby get worked on by the blonde who was finally about to make him come. How, I don't know, because she really wasn't doing it the way Bobby liked. She sucked it like she was afraid of it, not like she owned it. When Bobby looked at me, those eyes moving slow and oily over my body, I knew Bobby couldn't want anybody more than he wanted me. I was kneeling in front of Bobby, and he traced the outline of my jaw with his fingertips, felt like feathers when he did that. And he knew I especially liked it. On my knees in front of Bobby, I could see right before my eyes that he didn't really want to clean the kitchen, not right then. So I handled it like the blonde didn't know how to, like I owned it. So,
yeah.
In that scene, you don't get an actual blowjob. You just get the hint of it and we move on. So that's...
And now this is going to be our highest rated show ever as a result, which is nice.
Our most bleeps.
Exactly.
Our KPFK sensor is going to have calluses on his finger pressing that button so often. Dana Johnson, the author, the teacher, the lecturer on sex writing. We have to turn the thermostat down right now. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you, guys. This is fun.
Antoine Wilson has come in again to answer that question we like to ask some of our guests about the book they've read lately that has really most resonated with them.
Hi, yeah, it's interesting. Typically, a lot of the stuff that I've been reading has to do with consciousness and thinking and a lot of interiority and those sorts of things that we say that novels can do that films can't. So I was on this big Thomas Bernhard kick. He's this black bile Austrian with these super, super dark rants that cross right over into being very funny and yet serious at the same time. And then somehow I have moved into the realm of, let's say, moving a little farther away in terms of psychic distance with characters. And I read Michael Kohlhaas by Heinrich von Kleist, which is a sort of revenge tale set in the, 16th century and written in the 19th century. And it's basically about a guy it's based on a true story. And it's a guy who's bringing horses across this sort of border space. And he's told that he has to leave two of them behind because of, you know, a new leader in the region. And the guy who's the leader doesn't take care of the horses. He uses them in the fields. The horses get sick, so on and so forth. And Michael Kohlhaas decides to take revenge, and he organizes eventually, after not being able to sort of get any satisfaction through the courts, he organizes this rebel band that, you know, moves through the woods and they burn things down and they are essentially terrorists. Eventually, he is able to get some satisfaction, but this band of terrorists that he's created goes on and continues sort of without him and won't listen to his leadership anymore. And it is a sort of tremendously dense, plotty, old-fashioned story. And it's just a really, really fantastic read. And Heinrich von Kleist is maybe better known for The Marquise of O, which is also a fantastic story. So I've been dipping into the 19th century.
What was it that drew you to von Kleist?
That's a really good question. I think it was, is it Melville House that's been putting out those novellas as standalone copies?
Yeah, it is Melville House, a terrific series.
And I saw it sitting on the shelf at Diesel Books, which is my local store on the West Side. And I just, the name Michael Kohlhaas resonated with me. I guess I'd seen it somewhere before. And I thought, oh, what is that? I mean, it's as simple as that. I judge books by the titles all the time.
Mm-hmm. And of course, it is time for a von Kleist revival.
It has been.
And a bookstore revival.
Yeah, bring back bookstores.
We like all stories that involve a bookstore. Antoine, thanks for coming in to talk about this book. Again, it's called...
Michael Kohlhaas by Heinrich von Kleist. And a little footnote to that is the character Kohlhaas Walker in Dr. Rowe's Ragtime is explicitly modeled after Michael Kohlhaas.
Well,
I think I have to read it.
I knew that because Ragtime is a musical. All of my knowledge comes from musicals.
I'm Seth Greenland here with Tom Lutz and Lori Weiner here on the LARB Radio Hour, 90.7 FM, KPFK. Our next guest is Ray Dubow. She is the creator, the CEO of Talking Out Loud, a service that helps writers and other individuals who are not performers with their public presentation. Basically, Ray, you help them suck less.
I do. That's my goal, to help them suck less.
Having been, you know, all of us are writers. We've been in this racket a long time. And I think, I don't know if you guys, Tom and Lori, would agree with me on this, but I find most readings horrific.
The worst.
I hate readings.
Okay, good. I'm glad you said that because that's kind of what happened. I was going to readings. I was an acting coach, and by the end of them, I would just have so much frustration and anger, and it was usually directed at the reader, unfortunately.
Of course.
But I just thought, well, why don't they just hire an actor? Like, why are they reading their stuff? It's a disservice to their work, and it's certainly horrible for the audience. And I thought, all right, well, what would I do differently if I were working with a writer the way I used to work with actors? And I found that the things that worked for actors worked very well for writers. And with just a little bit of finessing, they did so much better and they were so much more comfortable and their audiences were so much happier. And I feel like I'm doing a service.
The main thing you do is say, read half as long.
That's a good one. Read half as long is good. But the other thing that I really is don't rush to the end. That's the biggest thing that I find with writers is they're so freaked out that all they want to do is get to the end of the piece. And so there's no room to breathe within the piece. There's no room for the audience to kind of sit back and hear a story. We all want to hear stories.
The worst reading we were ever at, and he will remain nameless, the entire reading sounded like this.
It was time was just stretched to an infinity.
Right.
No intonation whatsoever. Just kept going like this.
Yeah. Well, she would fix that, of course.
So if you're not comfortable, you really shouldn't read very long. And also, if people are terrified, I say to them, you know, just give an anecdote. You don't have to read from the book. What we want to see is the writer behind the words. Like, I want to see what they're like, right? And I also want to hear the story, but I also want to see the writer. That's why I'm at the reading. Otherwise, I'll go home and I'll read the book.
Right.
Writers, they're all snowflakes and everyone is an individual.
But yes.
I'm asking,
beautiful snowflake.
Is there a template that you work with when you make a writer into a public performer?
Well, the first thing I always say to everybody is don't be a dick. Like, that's the first rule. You know, if you go,
God, why didn't I think of that?
Right? Yeah. It's kind of cool.
The kind of career you could have had if somehow 25 years ago you had said that to yourself. I didn't want to think about
it. Yeah. Well, I mean, it's the only thing I always have a whiteboard with me, and it's the only thing I actually write on the whiteboard because I think it's really important that if you're going to a reading, like if you're doing a reading, have some snacks, have some drinks, thank the people who invited you there, maybe write a thank you note, because I always say, like, you know, let's say somebody comes into the bookstore and they're like, what do you suggest? Well, do you think if you've been a dick that they're going to suggest your book? They're not going to. But if you're like really cool and you give a good reading, maybe when somebody walks into the bookstore and says, hey, what do you recommend? You're like, oh my God, I just heard this great reading. This guy's great, or this gal's great, and you should totally buy this book.
I think that's kind of brilliant. It never would have occurred to me that a definition of dickishness is non-provision of snacks.
In my world,
it's very high on the list, for sure.
Yes, in my world, it's totally.
At what point do you recommend beta blockers?
I think anybody who needs a beta blocker should absolutely take a beta blocker. I am not above drugs, whatever it takes to get you through it, you know?
They are wonderful. I had one horrible experience with public speaking. It was a tribute to Larry Gelbart, and I was to interview him and some other people that he wrote some shows with, because it was about his theater experience. But I had to follow, I didn't know this, but I had to follow literally Carl Reiner, Mel Brooks, Alan Alda, and a monkey. No, not a monkey. But it was
monkey.
Like, yes. And I literally froze, and I could not get out of my little prison. It was horrible. It was the worst night of my life. I didn't do any public speaking again for like 5 years. And when I did, I took a beta blocker. And she was fine.
Brilliant.
It was absolutely fine. But I mean, it's because it's partly psychological, I'm sure, the beta blocker. But mm-hmm. but it does feel great to get over that, the hump of being terrified.
Right.
I mean, that's a huge freeing thing.
People are always going to be scared. That's the big thing. It's like you're scared because it's all about you. And so what I say to them is it's not all about you. It's actually more about your audience than about you. So if you can put the focus on the audience, and know, like, that voice that says, oh, I suck, oh, my voice sounds crazy, oh, you know, like, if you can just down that voice, like, turn it down a little bit and just set it out to the audience. Am I getting a reaction from you? Am I getting a reaction from you? And I talk to writers about, if I'm going to work with them on a specific piece, where's a good place to look up? Where's a good place to check in?
Yeah, I guess one of the things I'm thinking is that I do wish sometimes that I was had a larger personality. Right,
I don't wish that.
No, that I just could, you know, that I was just had a little bit more inflection in my own voice. I'm inflecting more right now as I'm saying this than I usually do.
Because you're more committed.
When I'm thinking out loud, I revert to my thinking out loud voice, which is a lot more like this than what I was just doing a minute ago. Because I'm thinking.
Right.
And so I'm not sure I can fix that unless I'm always performing.
Like, you were just really connected to the point you were saying, right? Mm-hmm. So your voice went up, you got excited, right? Mm-hmm. So the more people can be themselves, like, that's the real goal. Not to sound like something, not to be more animated. Whatever people have in their minds, I think that's a real problem. Like, I want to sound like that person. It's like, no, honey, you're never going to sound like that person.
Oh,
like, I worked with a writer. Yeah. But you have a great radio voice. Like,
oh,
you, yeah,
shucks,
no, you really do. You really do. And I mean, you guys have great radio voices too, but Tom, I was listening to public radio and I was like, oh, that's a really nice voice. And then I heard, oh, and it's Tom Les, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, oh my God, that's so great. But I worked with somebody who has a sixth grade education. And she said to me, I want to sound more educated. I want you to help me with my grammar. And I just looked at her and I said, I'm not going to do that. That's not how I work. I want to work with you as you are, because that's what's empowering the people. Somebody with a sixth grade education who wrote this book, who's got this incredible empire. She's an entrepreneur. She's built this incredible empire. I said, that's the person I want to hear. I don't want to hear the person who sounds like they went to Harvard. I want to hear you. And once I gave her the permission to do that, she was great. She was great. But she didn't feel she had the permission.
So do you think that you can eradicate the poet voice in our time?
I would love to eradicate the poet voice in our time. Oh my God. So do you want to talk about poet voice? Do you want to tell me what poet voice is for our listeners?
Please. Yeah. So what's poet voice?
Please.
You can do it.
Please.
Let us go then, you and I, when the evening is laid out beneath the sky.
like a patient etherized upon the table.
That was good. That was not quite as nasty as poet voice. Tom, you want to try your poet voice?
Let us go then, you and I.
I don't think so.
I don't know if we could use that actually.
That's a good idea.
That's not technically exactly poet voice.
Laurie, you want to take a stab at poet voice?
Let us go then, you and I.
No, that's by Catherine Hepburn.
That's by Catherine Hepburn.
That was a good Catherine Hepburn, actually.
Thank you.
And remarkably like Elliot himself.
I want to get the laugh down of the Catherine Hepburn.
One time I was sitting at the front desk at Knopf, and we had just published her book called Me.
Yes.
And she walked in off the elevator, and she said to me, she just looked at me, and she goes, "Where's Mary Maguire?" She didn't even say hello.
Yeah, well, by the book title, Me, you know what you're getting into.
You've listened to several of our shows.
I have.
Have at it.
Uh-oh.
Okay, well, I did take some notes on some of your shows, and just watching you guys, I noticed, Tom, it's so cool. You know, you're like this right now. Tom's, because we don't have video of this, Tom has his hands on his thighs, and he looks fairly comfortable. And in the last segment, his arms were crossed most of the time. And so, yeah. And I thought, oh, well, that might be a way for him to feel good, but it's also off-putting to the person you're speaking with, although she did a great job. But psychologically, it might have an impact on you as well, because it closes you off, right? Because I think posture is really important. I think how we sit, I'm all about opening ourselves up. And I notice, Seth, you're really straight in the chair. Seth sits very straight. He has beautiful posture.
Very nice posture. I've been meaning to say that to you, Seth, all this year.
He does. And so, like, it he's, like, ready to go. He's right in front. Like, I get that feeling. Like, he's on it, you know? And Lori's just kind of like hanging out. You know, she's got a very relaxed way about her, and she puts in the zingers. Like, I love that, Lori, you put in the zingers. You're like the comedy relief on these guys.
But that's all I can do, so that's what
I'm Well, saying. I think you do it very well. Thank you.
Have you ever thought about the public speaking, and I'm not joking, of Hitler?
The public speaking of Hitler?
Yeah, because they say that he was, you know, when we look at films, it's hard to see it, but they say that he was so mesmerizing, you know, in the moment. What?
And he brought snacks.
And he brought snacks. Yes, he did bring snacks.
What Leni Riefenstahl doesn't show you in those films is the snack table.
There were snacks everywhere.
Because he knew.
Ray, if there are people who want to avail themselves of your expertise, how can they get in touch with you?
Well, they can look at my website at www.talkingoutloud.net. And I can also be reached at ray@talkingoutloud.net.
And that's Ray, R-A-E.
R-A-E, yes. Thank you for that. At talkingoutloud.net.
Ray Dubo, thank you for coming in to talk to us.
Thank you so much. This was great. Thank you so much.
That's our show for today. Thanks to Dana Johnson, Antoine Wilson, Ray Dubo. Our apologies to BJ Novak. We ran out of time again, but he said he'll come back next week. We hope he will. Find us on the web at www.lareviewofbooks.org. Download us on iTunes. Better yet, give us a rating. 5 stars is always a good thing. For Tom Lutz and Laurie Weiner, this is Seth Greenland. Thanks for listening to the LARB Radio Hour, and we will see you next week.
The LARB Radio Hour!
Blah!